Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Jonathan Evans. Later, Bob Doty, Tony Riggs, and Frank Oliver bring us the latest in the ongoing American history series, Making of a Nation. But first, this report. Luis Alves da Cruz awoke in the middle of the night. He heard the sounds of loud activity in the Paraguayan prison where he lived. Later, he told police that he saw a group of other prisoners wearing all black clothing. "We're breaking out," one of them told him. "Are you coming?" Da Cruz is 30 years old and a native of Brazil. He is in prison for smuggling illegal drugs. Within minutes, he was among 75 prisoners who fled the prison in the early hours of January 19th. It was one of the most shocking escapes in Paraguay's history. The fleeing prisoners were members of the First Capital Command. The group is also known as the PCC. The PCC is Brazil's largest and most powerful criminal organization. The escape demonstrates the organization's growing influence in Paraguay. The country's weak institutions have been unable to deal with the PCC and other Brazilian criminal groups that are growing quickly there. Cecilia Perez is Paraguay's justice minister. She said officials at the prison in the city of Pedro Juan Caballero, near the Paraguay-Brazil border, knew what the PCC was planning. "Some even helped the escape effort," she said. 32 prison officials, including the jail's warden, are now under arrest. "We're facing a security crisis whose epicenter lies in the prison system," Perez told the Reuters news agency.
The Pedro Juan Caballero Regional Penitentiary did not answer Reuters' request for comment. 40 of the escapees, including Da Cruz, were Brazilians. So far, officials have recaptured only 11 prisoners. They found Da Cruz within days of the escape near the Brazilian town of Duraduz. Brazilian police let a Reuters reporter read the records of what Da Cruz said about the escape. Da Cruz told police that guards at the Paraguayan prison had helped with the escape. He said he was among those who fled through a tunnel that prisoners had dug. The tunnel had a fan to bring in fresh air and even electric lights. The tight passage started in a cell holding PCC members and exited just outside the jail's outer wall. Older prisoners simply walked out the front door. This escape demonstrates that the PCC does what it wants, when it wants, said Juan Martens. He is an education and security researcher based in the capital, Asunción. He has studied the PCC's activities in Paraguay. "The Paraguayan state represents no barrier to its plans," he said.
Paraguay is one of the world's top producers of the illegal drug marijuana. It is also a major transportation point for all the illegal drug cocaine made in the Andes Mountains. Transparency International's 2019 Corruption Perceptions Index lists it as the second most corrupt country in South America after Venezuela. As a result, it has become a desirable operational base for Brazilian criminal organizations. This includes the Sao Paulo-based PCC, Rio de Janeiro's Red Command, and a Porto Alegre group called Bullet in the Face. Officials say Brazilian criminals operate with little fear of the law here, both inside and outside the prison. The area around the prison, Pedro Juan Caballero, has been called the City of Blood. Small planes carrying Bolivian cocaine often touch down on landing areas outside Pedro Juan Caballero, Brazilian and Paraguayan officials told Reuters. From there, they said, the drugs move through southern Brazil and on to Europe, where demand is high. The effects can be seen in the rising number of deaths in Pedro Juan Caballero. Gangs fight to control drug transportation pathways, officials said. Mayor José Carlos Acevedo said there were more than 150 killings last year in the city of 120,000 people. He said residents live in fear of the gangs.
The police are completely corrupt, Acevedo said. The city's police force, which does not report to Acevedo, did not answer Reuters' requests for comment. Perez, the justice minister, said Paraguay would work together more with Brazil's right-wing government. Brazilian leaders are trying to limit the gang's activities by hitting their finances and sending bosses to high-security federal prisons. Gilberto Fleitas, the Paraguayan criminal investigations chief, doubts the chances of success. There's no way that anyone can stand up to this, he said. The gangs identify your family. They coerce your relatives, judges, prosecutors, police. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
A new study suggests some dinosaurs survived periods of strong volcanic activity about 183 million years ago in what is now South Africa. Scientists recently described fossil footprints discovered from dinosaurs dating back to the early Jurassic geologic period. The footprints were discovered on a present-day farm in South Africa's Karoo Basin. During the early Jurassic period, the area experienced intense volcanic activity, including massive lava flows. The activity may have caused great harm to the local environment and changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. Fossils examined from the time provide evidence that the volcanic activity caused mass extinctions of many species, both on land and in the oceans. Because there is often a lack of skeletal bones, fossil footprints are sometimes the only evidence that animals were present in an ancient environment. The footprints are in sandstone found between layers of volcanic rock. Researchers say the fossils show that the prints belonged to at least three different animals that walked near the sandy edge of a stream. The scientists believe the footprints are proof that some dinosaurs and other animals were able to survive in the area during quieter periods between volcanic explosions. Geologist Emmis Bordy is with South Africa's University of Cape Town. She calls such animals Karoo firewalkers. They were among the last animals known to have lived through the period's extreme conditions. But Bordy also noted hot was hot back then, too. So no, they did not walk on the lava. Bordy said the footprints were from both meat and plant-eating dinosaurs. One was a relatively small two-legged meat-eating dinosaur. Another was a similarly small four-legged dinosaur that likely ate plants, while the third may have been an early mammal species. The footprints were found in plant remains and sediment samples from rivers and lakes. Bordy said, for short time periods, the streams were flowing again, the sun was shining, the plants were growing, and the animals, among them dinosaurs, were grazing and hunting. She added, this story helps us change the way we see life in stressful and hostile environments, and thus improves our understanding of the history of life on Earth. Bordy and other researchers published their findings in the journal PLOS ONE. I'm Brian Lynn.
Young people now in their mid-20s to late-30s grew up during the Great Recession, the worst economic period in the United States since the 1930s. Many in this group, called millennials, experienced a late entrance into the job market or accepted lower-paying jobs for which they were overqualified. The Great Recession lasted from 2007 until 2009, but its effects were longer lasting. Now, observers say the 2020s might mean a better financial future for millennials after their difficult start. Many millennials starting out faced high unemployment, student loan debt, and an increased cost of living. These factors especially affected millennials who completed high school or college during the recession. Jason Dorsey is president and lead millennial researcher at the Center for Generational Kinetics. He told VOA that since the recession, wages in the United States have largely stayed the same. He says, so many millennials started behind where they thought they would be, and it's taken them longer to recover if they have recovered. Experts also say U.S. millennials are the first generation to feel the full impact of many years of rising inequality in America. A recent study found millennials are financially worse off than members of past generations at the same age. Since 1996, the net worth of people under 35 has dropped by more than 34%. However, things could be more hopeful for these younger Americans. The average U.S. millennial is now over the age of 30 and ready to enter the wealth-gaining time of their life. Dorsey says millennials have had a lot of time to learn about what it takes to succeed. He says members of the boomer generation people aged 55 to 75 are going to increasingly leave the workforce. He says that is going to create chances for millennials to actually move up into more management-style jobs. Millennials are at the age when Americans traditionally buy homes, start saving for the future, and invest for their retirement. It also will help that many have paid down their student debt now that they have been out of college for a number of years. Dorsey adds that many millennials may become two-income households, and that's also really helpful for many of them. He says, millennials are hitting the times when they should start really saving and investing and earning higher incomes relative to their spending. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. After the end of World War I, President Woodrow Wilson sought national support for his idea of a League of Nations. He took his appeal directly to the American people in the summer of 1919. Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver continue the story of Wilson's campaign.
The plan for the League of Nations was part of the peace treaty that ended World War I. By law, the United States Senate would have to vote on the treaty. President Wilson believed the Senate would have to approve it if the American people demanded it. So he went to the people for support. For almost a month, Wilson traveled across America. He stopped in many places to speak about the need for the League of Nations. He said the League was the only hope for world peace. It was the only way to prevent another world war. Wilson's health grew worse during the long journey across the country. He became increasingly weak and suffered from severe headaches. In Wichita, Kansas, he had a small stroke. A blood vessel burst inside his brain. He was forced to return to Washington.
For a few days, President Wilson's condition improved. Then, his wife found him lying unconscious on the floor of his bedroom in the White House. Wilson had lost all feeling in the left side of his body. He was near death. The president's advisors kept his condition secret from almost everyone. They told reporters only that Wilson was suffering from a nervous breakdown. For the next few days, the medical reports from the White House were always the same. They said Mr. Wilson's condition had not changed. People began to wonder, were they being told the truth? Some people began to believe that the president was, in fact, dead. Vice President Thomas Marshall was worried. If the president died or could not govern, then he, Marshall, would become president. But even Vice President Marshall could get no information from Wilson's doctors.
After several weeks, the president seemed to get a little stronger. He was still very weak. He could not work except to sign several bills. This simple act took most of his strength. Wilson's wife, Edith, guarded her husband closely. She alone decided who could see him. She alone decided what information he could receive. All letters and messages to Woodrow Wilson were given first to Edith Wilson. She decided if they were important enough for him to see. Most, she decided, were not. She also prevented members of the cabinet and other government officials from communicating with him directly. Mrs. Wilson's actions made many people suspect that she, not her husband, was governing the country. Some spoke of her as the nation's first woman president.
There was one issue Mrs. Wilson did discuss with her husband, the League of Nations. The Senate was completing debate on the Treaty of Versailles. That was the World War I peace agreement that contained Wilson's plan for the League. It seemed clear the Senate would reject the treaty. Too many senators feared the United States would lose some of its independence and freedom if it joined the League. The leader of Wilson's political party in the Senate, Gilbert Hitchcock, headed the administration campaign to win support for the treaty. He received Mrs. Wilson's permission to visit her husband. Hitchcock told the president the situation was hopeless. He said the Senate would not approve the treaty unless several changes were made to protect American independence. If the president accepted the changes, then the treaty might pass.
Wilson refused. He would accept no compromise. He said the treaty must be approved as written. Senator Hitchcock made one more attempt to get Wilson to reconsider. On the day the Senate planned to vote on the treaty, he went back to the White House. He told Mrs. Wilson that compromise offered the only hope for success. Mrs. Wilson went into the president's room while Hitchcock waited. She asked her husband, "Will you not accept the changes and get this thing settled?" He answered, "I cannot. Better 1,000 times to go down fighting than to surrender to dishonorable compromise."
The Senate voted. Hitchcock's fears proved correct. The treaty was defeated. The defeat ended Wilson's dream of American membership in the League of Nations. Mrs. Wilson gave the news to her husband. He was silent for a long time. Then he said, "I must get well." Woodrow Wilson was extremely sick, yet he was not the kind of man who accepted opposition or defeat easily. From his sickbed, he wrote a letter to the other members of the Democratic Party. He urged them to continue debate on the League of Nations. He said a majority of Americans wanted the treaty approved. Wilson probably was correct about this. Most Americans did approve of membership in the League of Nations. But they also wanted to be sure membership would not restrict American independence.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee agreed to reopen discussion on the treaty. It searched yet again for a compromise. It made new efforts to get Wilson to accept some changes. But, as before, Wilson refused. He was a proud man, and he thought many of the senators were evil men trying to destroy his plan for international peace. Wilson's unwillingness to compromise helped kill the treaty once and for all. The Senate finally voted again, and the treaty was defeated by 7 votes. The treaty was dead. The United States would never enter the League of Nations. And one of the most emotional and personal stories in the making of the American nation had ended.
The long battle over the Treaty of Versailles ended with political defeat for Woodrow Wilson. Yet, history would prove him correct. Wilson had warned time and again during the debate that a terrible war would result if the world did not come together to protect the peace. 20 years later, war came. The First World War had been called the war to end all wars, but it was not, and the Second World War would be far more destructive than the first.
The debate over the Treaty of Versailles was the central issue in American politics during the end of Woodrow Wilson's administration. It also played a major part in the presidential election of 1920. Wilson himself could not be a candidate again. He was much too sick. So the Democratic Party nominated a former governor of Ohio, James Cox. Cox shared Wilson's opinion that the United States should join the League of Nations. He campaigned actively for American membership. The Republican Party chose Senator Warren Harding as its candidate for president. Harding campaigned by promising a return to what he called normal times. He said it was time for America to stop arguing about international events and start thinking about itself again.
The two presidential candidates gave the American people a clear choice in the election of 1920. On one side was Democrat James Cox. He represented the dream of Woodrow Wilson. In this dream, the world would be at peace, and America would be a world leader that would fight for the freedom and human rights of people everywhere. On the other side was Republican Warren Harding. He represented an inward-looking America. It was an America that felt it had sacrificed enough for other people. Now, it would deal with its own problems. Warren Harding won the election.
The results of the election shocked and hurt Woodrow Wilson. He could not understand why the people had turned from him and his dream of international unity and peace. But the fact was that America was entering a new period in its history. For a long time, it would turn its energy away from the world beyond its borders.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. And find more stories, quizzes, and English learning activities, including videos and lessons, on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Thank you for listening to The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.